Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. And by Penn Medicine.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott.
I know what I want to say, but it doesn't come out clearly. I want to tell you so much, but I can't.
Mike McGale is 51. He closes his eyes to concentrate.
I'm sorry, but I hear everything. I know what's going on around me, but I just can't respond to it as quickly as I used to.
Mike had a stroke about a year and a half ago, a blood clot in the brain, and with that, he lost the ability to communicate clearly.
It's a tough thing. I started out with one word per day. Today's a bad day for me.
Language is one of our most important human tools. Maybe the most important one. It's how we connect with the world around us, express who we are, interact with others. On today's episode, we'll hear stories about language.
There is this recognition of, oh my gosh, everything has a name. Oh my gosh, I can put these concepts together.
Understanding how we learn it.
What is it about the human mind that enables language to exist at all?
Can you say hello?
Hello.
Giving language to people who've been voiceless, literally.
I am donating my voice to someone I've never met.
And the quest to come up with a perfect brand new language.
Mi deziras mian hundon.
Alana Gordon is here now to get us started. Hey, Alana.
Hey, Maiken.
And Alana, you looked at what happens when people lose their ability to speak, to process language, and also what we could possibly learn from that.
Yep. And so what Mike, who we just heard from, has is something called aphasia. And aphasia can actually reveal a lot about how language works and how it doesn't. It's a condition that can manifest differently for different people, depending on the type of damage to the brain. So it can cause difficulties in reading, writing, speaking, comprehension, all these things that are so essential, but we may not notice on a day-to-day basis. But the thing is, aphasia is often misunderstood.
It affects language processing. It does not affect intelligence.
Karen Cohen is a speech language pathologist, and I met her and Mike and others at Moss Rehab's Aphasia Center in suburban Philadelphia.
And that's really important because the word that's used here is that when people with aphasia talk, other people think they're stupid. And that can be the perception.
Karen runs a weekly conversation group, and she and others are sitting around this long rectangular table in a bright room at the rehab center. The focus here is on building social connections and confidence and communication strategies for when the words just won't come or when they're all jumbled up.
I'm a tired microbiologist.
That's Richard Berman. He's 74, and he had a stroke 6 years ago. As a result, he struggled to say this word, microbiologist, his lifelong profession. But here, everyone encourages him to keep trying and to keep practicing, with the help of some lighthearted teasing.
We like to make him say it as much as we can because of the way his speech was affected for his stroke. Somebody else can say it and not have any trouble with it. But the strategy he actually uses is to say it one syllable at a time, and it comes out perfectly.
Microbiologist.
Yay.
She's fine.
This group is actually part of a growing shift in how aphasia is treated. But Maiken, science itself actually owes a lot to this condition, aphasia, for what it has revealed to us about language systems and the inner workings of the brain itself. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's cue up the neuroscientist.
aphasia in the setting of stroke is actually one of the most important disorders in the history of neurology for establishing the idea that there is a relationship between different regions of the brain, different centers, and cognitive ability.
Roy Hamilton runs a lab for cognition and neural stimulation at the University of Pennsylvania. He says in the mid-1800s, a patient who became known as Tan completely shook the medical field.
And the reason he was referred to that as Tan was because after he had had his lesion in his brain, that was the sound that he primarily generated. Instead of coherent speeches, Tan, Tan.
So he would walk around being like, Tan, Tan?
Yeah, you would ask him questions. He would try to answer effortfully, frustratedly, and that's what he would produce, Tan.
When Tan died, the neurologist Pierre-Paul Broca studied his brain. And he saw that the left frontal area of Tan's brain was the part that was damaged. And what that told him, what that told us, is that for most people, language is localized in the brain in the front left hemisphere. It's an area that now bears Broca's name.
And we now often refer to patients who have this problem that predominantly involves the production of language as having a Broca's type aphasia.
This idea that certain parts of the brain are responsible for specific functions was really big at that time, and it's a concept that still continues. So you have damage to one part of your brain where language works, language is impaired, right?
Yeah, makes sense.
But there's more to it, because even when part of the brain that's responsible for language, let's say, is damaged, the brain can still recover language function. Right, so Roy says other parts of the brain may work to compensate for this and find alternate paths. Plus, language, it's not entirely siloed in just one part of the brain.
One of the big things that we now understand to be different is that the brain is not static in its function.
It has a plasticity, or neuroplasticity, to it. Roy and others can better observe this in the brain thanks to modern imaging, like fMRIs. He has studied dozens of people who've had strokes months and years later. And what he can see is that the brain is working around that damage. Parts of the right side of the brain light up.
In an effort to process and speak language.
Yeah. But now, Mikan, he wants to take it a step further. And that is the sound of what?
That's the sound of transcranial magnetic stimulation. That is the jostling of wrappings of wire inside this coil.
Roy fires up the electromagnetic stimulator machine that's in his lab.
I would describe them as about the size of a 1980s VCR.
This therapy, where you take magnetic pulses and focus it on the head that then stimulates certain parts of the brain, is actually approved as a targeted treatment for depression. But he wants to figure out how to use it to help stimulate the brain to activate language recovery. But before he can do that, Mikan, he has to figure out what are the properties of how the brain decides what alternate pathways to take, and then how effective those pathways really are.
Wow, that sounds super complicated.
I know. But there is a more urgent question, especially for those people who wind up at the aphasia center or maybe never make it there, which is this. How much time does the brain actually have to repair itself? Roy says the traditional thinking has been you kind of plateau after about 6 months after having something like a stroke. It is true that therapy is critical during that time, but
there is more evidence to suggest that in general, this arc of recovery is likely much longer than we think it is.
The brain continues to repair and recover language over time.
Well, I think speech-language pathologists have always known that.
Sharon Antonucci is director of Moss Rehab's Aphasia Center.
While there are no guarantees about where you will end up in your recovery, opportunities for rehabilitation and opportunities for improving and increasing communication skills are lifelong.
Sharon worries that people may stop getting therapy and even worse, kind of give up 6 months after their stroke. Because what they're often hearing from their doctor is that they won't get any better after that.
And that message seems to be fairly pervasive. And I think it's a message that is created due to lack of education and lack of experience.
She says the implications of this are huge. Because social interaction is a critical part of the rehabilitation process. But losing that ability to communicate is incredibly isolating.
A piece of data that is going to be coming out soon suggests that 20% of people who are 6 months after stroke with aphasia report having no friends.
So if you look down somewhere around 10 lines, it says Jones was an indispensable, mysterious... Anybody have it?
A few doors down from Sharon's office, the conversation group transitions into a midday book club. Charlie Salbert volunteers to read a passage.
Fighting the shadow war along the watery borders between the Union and rebel territory.
He had a stroke 3 years ago. Initially, he says his daughters had to really push him to attend this group because he was so scared about not being able to speak around others.
And his mastery of the river was so complete.
What do you think would have happened had you not come here?
I'd still be sitting in the house. I don't think my speech would be as good as it is now. And I think I'd be sitting home alone, just wondering what to do.
Even able to calculate the most propitious time.
For Charlie and others I talked to here, spaces like this are a lifeline. Because here, they're able to do something that's really hard to do outside. Finally complete their sentences, no matter how long that might take.
It may sound strange to you, but it's important that people understand that people with aphasia need time to finish their sentences. Don't interrupt them. I mean, that's probably the worst thing you can do, because it's very, not only demeaning, but it's, what's the word I'm looking for? Destructive to their confidence.
Thank you, Alana.
Thanks, Mikan.
We're talking about language. You're listening to The Pulse.
Esto es The Pulse.
Il Polso.
El Pulso.
Ви слушаєте Пульс.
Ви тисмай The Pulse.
How do we process language? And how do humans learn it in the first place? Let's say you get a kitten and you also have a baby around the same time.
You talk baby talk to the baby, you talk baby talk to the kitten. The baby's going to grow up speaking whatever language you've been talking to them, and the kitten is not.
That's Gretchen McCullough. She is a linguist, and she says people in her field are really puzzled by how and why humans talk when none of the other animals do.
What is it about the human mind that enables language to exist at all?
There are many theories, of course.
So there's this one idea that maybe we just memorize all of the possible sentences, right? So you can imagine, well, we learn all of the possible words and we learn all the possible sentences. And when I say, hey, how are you? It's because I've heard my mother say, hey, how are you? But you can create a sentence that has never been said before in human history. You know, you can say, like, fluffy green bananas fly around in the cosmosphere. And I'm pretty sure no one said that before. And yet you understood me.
Right.
So if you were just learning language by memorizing stuff, you wouldn't be able to parse fluffy green bananas.
Right. So
there's got to be something abstract kind of that you acquire that allows you to figure out that things can combine to create meaning. You're not just a robot that's memorizing or regurgitating things you've heard before.
So what is it that allows us to understand language, to create meaning? Linguists can't agree. Is language a feature of our general intelligence, or is there something innate in our brains that lets language happen?
And there's been a couple different waves of hypothesizing what that language specific thing might be. It depends on which era you're looking at. It's really hard to do this without drawing diagrams.
Does this ever get really weird in your head when you start thinking so much about language? It gets a bit.
I think it's very common among linguists to say, I've been thinking about language for so often, I can't trust any of my own intuitions about language. I've got to go ask my roommate, or I've got to go ask, you know, the person down the hall. Does this sentence sound okay to you? Does this look like a real word? It's kind of like if you just keep saying the word, like, you know, apple over and over again. Apple, 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 apple. It'll start sounding really weird.
Gretchen McCullough is a linguist, and she has a podcast called Lingthusiasm. Das ist der Puls, Geschichten über die Menschen und Orte am Herzen von Gesundheit und Wissenschaft. Ich heiße Maiken Skat. I'm just kidding. Our show today is about language, and it's really hard to communicate when we don't speak the same language. English is the world's dominant language, which is why I had to learn it in high school, and that is true in science as well. Most research papers today are published in English. But about 100 years ago, scientists used many different languages, and that became really confusing. Enter the quest to create a simple universal way to communicate. Joel Wolfram has this story.
Chances are you've never heard of Volapük. Gloro and Novial probably don't ring any bells either. But maybe you've heard of this one.
Let me think of something I can say in Esperanto. Mi deziras mian hundon, which means I want my dog.
Michael Gordon is a professor at Princeton University who studies the history of modern science.
Many of the words sound somewhat comical to English speakers. The word for bird in Esperanto is birdo.
Michael says scientists were enthusiastic supporters of goofy-sounding universal languages when dozens of them began to be invented in the late 1800s. Science was booming back then, and if you wanted to keep up, you had to know a lot of different languages. At first, most scientific works were published in three languages, English, French, and German. But then that started to change.
Starting around the 1860s and 70s, you get expansion of railroad networks, you get expansion of telegraph networks, people travel more easily.
As the world became more interconnected, the language barriers between scientists traveling around Europe became harder to ignore. And discoveries were starting to be published in even more languages, such as Japanese and Russian. Michael says people were worried they were heading toward a scientific babble, where nobody could understand each other. Enter the idea of a universal language, created from scratch. Esperanto was one of the most popular of these constructed languages. It was invented by Polish ophthalmologist L.L. Zamenhof and designed to be very easy to learn. The vocabulary draws on familiar root words from European languages, and its pronunciation and grammar consistently follow the same rules.
It sounds vaguely like Portuguese.
In 1907,
an international delegation of scientists meets in Paris to decide which of the constructed languages will become the new official language of science. Esperanto is the front runner. But some of the delegates think it doesn't make the grade.
Esperanto is a pretty good language, but it has some quirks and weirdnesses and flaws, and people quibble about it, so they want to create a new language that's going to be absolutely perfect.
The delegates vote for a reformed version of Esperanto called Ido, but most Esperanto speakers remain loyal to the original and refuse to take up Ido. That creates a schism, which doesn't bode well for the adoption of an international language of science.
The perfect is the enemy of the good.
But in the end, it was World War I that spelled doom for this project.
The war ruptures internationalist instincts as people devolve into nationalism and fight.
After the war, the quest to find an ideal constructed language has lost steam. German also falls out of favor. There's even a 7-year boycott against German scientists. Michael says that left an opening for English to become dominant and offer a way out of the scientific Tower of Babel.
So English does a lot of the things that Esperanto was originally intended to do. That comes with giving a huge advantage to native speakers of that language. Esperanto was supposed to be fair and do that. And what we have now is something that does that, but isn't fair.
It's not that perfect solution scientists were hoping for a century ago. For The Pulse, I'm Joel Wolfram.
We're talking about language and our difficulties communicating with each other. So how about using symbols instead of words? No, I'm not talking about emojis. I'm talking about math, which some people have called a universal language. One of the early proponents of that idea was Italian astronomer Galileo. But is math really a language? Alan Yu checked into this.
Eugenia Chang studies pure mathematics. That means she studies math for its own sake. And she wants to make math less scary by bringing it to the people. She even went on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert to talk about how we can learn exponentials by eating puff pastry.
What, and I don't want to get too technical here, the hell does that mean?
It means taking very simple ingredients like we have here, butter and flour, doing complicated things with them and making something delicious.
Okay, I'm slightly scared of you right now.
For work, Eugenia sometimes has to read math books in another language, like German. She does know a little German from being a pianist.
The German songs of Schubert and Brahms are all about romantic poetry. So my German vocabulary is mostly about love and death. And that's not very helpful for reading a math paper.
But take the words out, leaving the numbers, signs, notation, that part of math stays the same.
There were so many diagrams and so many formulae, equations, and essentially pictures that it was not too difficult. You don't have to understand that much of the foreign language in order to understand math in that language. So in that way, it kind of feels like another language to me.
Eugenia says her research is like translating between English and math.
So I can think about the world in English, and then I can package it up in this tight little piece of mathematics and send it to someone who doesn't speak English, and then they can understand it using their own language.
That packaging can make your communication much more efficient. Here's an example. The Greek mathematician Archimedes described an equation for the area of a circle in sentences. Get ready for this.
The area of any circle is equal to a right-angled triangle, in which one of the sides about the right angle is equal to the radius, and the other to the circumference of the circle.
And here's the math version. A equals pi r squared. That's it. Math is a tool that helps us convey precision, and sometimes that precision is absolutely essential. Think about when a plane is about to land. The air traffic controller tells the pilot exactly how to descend. Normally, a transmission from the control tower sounds like this recording from liveatc.net.
Air Control 31, fly heading 210 for sequence. Expect to resume the arrival. Descend to maintain 7,000.
Without math, it might sound like this. Just bear with me.
American 1231, you're too close to another airplane, so turn a little bit left, but not too far left. Expect to turn again exactly when it's safe. Also, there's another plane coming toward you, so change your height above the ground enough so that you don't collide, but not too far because it's busy today and my airspace is really crowded.
We would never be able to fly safely without precise measurements. All that definitely makes math feel like a language, but I still wasn't convinced it actually is one. So I asked a linguist, Charles Yang from the University of Pennsylvania.
Can we say that math, like mathematics, is that a language?
It is an informal sense of a language, but it does not have the properties of human language.
So it's like a language, but not officially. Real languages are self-contained ways of communicating. Using just English or Chinese or German, you can make yourself understood without the help of another language. Math can't do that. You can go a long way with just numbers and symbols in math, but eventually you'll need words. Math represents ideas and concepts we've already defined in other languages. For example, in E equals MC squared, you have to define E and M and C with words. E is energy, M is mass, and C is the speed of light. Math is great, but Charles Yang says language is almost a biological necessity for us humans, and math is not. For him, that's the most important difference between math and an official language.
You put a bunch of deaf kids together, in a few generations they'll invent a language. I think it's inconceivable you put some people together on some remote island, isolated from everything else. In a few generations, they'll even, you know, mathematics.
Charles says language is our biological destiny. Math, maybe not so much. So back to Galileo and his ideas about math. He wrote that the Book of the Universe is, quote, written in the language of mathematics, and its characters are triangles and circles. That sounds poetic, but he wasn't being literal. Galileo was right about many things, but he wasn't a linguist. For The Pulse, I'm Alan Yu.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about language. Language is unique to humans, but communication is not. Animals make themselves heard by howling, chirping, barking, or meowing. And scientists are also learning more about how plants message each other, which sadly is not audible to our ears. It's all done in chemical signals.
So there's a sender and a receiver, and typically that signal might modify the behavior of the receiver.
That's John Orrock. He is a biology professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he says one reason plants communicate is to warn each other of dangers.
Plants that are wounded by herbivores, so you know, organisms like caterpillars that chew on the leaf of a plant, those plants emit chemicals that can be detected by a nearby plant, and the nearby plant, when it detects those chemicals, might start to change its own chemical composition so that it becomes less tasty. So that if an herbivore happens to land on that plant next and start to eat it, the plant has already started to defend itself. We've documented many different examples of the same kind of communication between lots of different plant species, from things like tomato to trees like sugar maple, beans and corn, and barley.
What does that look like in a lab? How do you study that?
Well, it begins with, you know, providing the plant with a pencil and something to write on. That's an essential component. So a simple scenario would be to have two plants, one sitting next to another, and you allow caterpillars to attack one of the plants, but not the other. And then you simply manipulate whether or not the two plants share the same air column, so whether or not chemicals can move between the two plants. And so you can do that simple experiment, and the hypothesis is that if the plants are communicating, if you allow those chemicals to move from one plant through the air and be detected by another plant, then the receiver plant should be less tasty if you put a caterpillar on that receiver plant after it's received the information.
So plants can talk to other kinds of plants, not just the exact same type of plant they are, right?
So biologists would call that intraspecific communication versus interspecific communication. So whether or not you're communicating with a member of your species or whether or not you're communicating with a different species. Now, something that's really important to realize is that most of these examples of communication by chemicals that leak out of a damaged plant typically occur over pretty short distances. So we're talking about, you know, a few inches, a few feet, not particularly long. And that might make sense if you think about it, because those chemical signals, once they come out of the damaged plant, can rapidly become diluted in a windy environment or if they have to move a long distance before they get to the receiver plant. And so in this way, the communication is a bit dose dependent, but for very small plants attempting to communicate with very large plants, especially over long distances, I think that might be a tricky proposition.
So why do plants do this? What's in it for them?
Oh, there's so many interesting and cool hypotheses. For example, this communication actually is very beneficial because it's a way for a plant to communicate with itself. And so you can imagine that, you know, plants have all these vascular connections inside of them where water and compounds are moving back and forth in the plant, but some parts of the plant aren't always well connected to other parts of the plant. And so if one of your leaves is being attacked by a caterpillar, the best way to let the rest of the plant know that you're under attack might actually be for airborne chemicals to leak out of that leaf so that the rest of the plant can be notified.
Do plants only communicate with other plants, or are these messages potentially also picked up by other species altogether, by animals, by birds?
Sure. And the answer is yes. There's research that suggests that predators and parasites that attack herbivores use those chemicals to find herbivores and kill them. So plants that are emitting these compounds benefit because they're effectively calling in bodyguards that can come help defend them from this herbivore that's currently eating them, which might also be helpful if you're a plant and you're rooted in the ground and you can't run away when the caterpillar's attacking you.
John Orrock is a biology professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Supporting the Pulse, Penn Neurosciences. At Penn Neurosciences, brain and spine specialists work together to help people break through the darkness of their disease, from delivering clinical research to finding new approaches to treat MS and epilepsy to developing advanced procedures for brain and spine disorders. The Penn Neurosciences team cares for each patient and their individual needs. More information is available at pennmedicine.org/neuro.
你正在收听 The Pulse, 一个介绍科学工作者的故事，走访他们的工作环境。
That was Alan Yu speaking Mandarin, one of four languages Alan speaks. Today's show is about language, how we learn it, what it is not, how we communicate with each other. Our next story takes us to Salinas, California, which is also known as the salad bowl of the world. Everywhere you look, you see fields of lettuce, strawberries, broccoli. The local hospital is called Natividad, and it serves many of the people who work in those fields. Lots of them speak indigenous Mexican languages, but not English or Spanish. That made healthcare difficult in the past, but a few years ago, the hospital started an interpreting program to bridge that divide. Reporter Nina Porzuki met one of their interpreters.
When Israel Lino was a teenager, his mother brought his baby sister to Natividad Hospital. His mom only speaks Triqui, an indigenous Mexican language, and she was unable to communicate with the doctor just how sick her baby was.
They were in the hospital like around 8 hours waiting, and the baby had a fever and really high fever, and at that time, the doctors didn't know what to do.
His little sister died. And all of this occurred while Israel's mom had little grasp of what was going on.
So that's why, for my little sister, that's why I became an interpreter.
Now 21, Israel works as a medical interpreter at Natividad Hospital.
Where are we going, Israel?
We're going to be going to MIU, Maternal Infant Unit.
Okay.
The other interpreters like to tease Israel. They call him El Bebe. Despite his very adult blue blazer, he's got a baby face, dimples. Today, El Bebe is interpreting for two new parents who just had a baby. Israel speaks English, Spanish, and Triqui, a language spoken in parts of the rural mountainous state of Oaxaca. Triqui is about as related to Spanish as, say, English is to Mandarin. There were no Triqui interpreters when Israel's sister died. In fact, it would have been hard to find a certified Spanish language interpreter at Natividad back then. This was a problem, says Linda Ford. She's the CEO of the hospital's foundation. She remembers speaking with one doctor.
He was so frustrated and just said, "Oh my goodness, I can't talk to my patients. I cannot talk to my patients."
Linda discovered that four of the most commonly spoken languages of patients coming to the hospital were all native Mexican languages.
I thought, well, I'll just hire indigenous interpreters, so let me find an agency that can provide interpreters. And I Googled indigenous languages to try to find interpreters, and nothing came up on the Google.
But her search for help did lead her to Victor Sosa, a certified Spanish language medical interpreter.
I remember the first month I was here, I did 300 interpretations just myself, and that was it.
Well, you know,
that was the whole department.
When he came to Natividad 7 years ago, he began working with Linda to develop a Spanish interpreting program. And in the process, Victor discovered that there actually were indigenous language interpreters at the hospital. Just no one saw them that way.
And then Angelica came along.
Angelica Isidro speaks Spanish and another Mexican language, Mixteco. For 20 years, she has been informally interpreting for anyone in her community that needed help. People would call her at all hours, from the hospital, the courts, and jails.
Yo interpretaba donde yo trabajaba porque yo trabajaba en el field.
I'd interpret where I worked in the field, she tells me. I put the telephone beneath the bandana that was covering my face, and I'd keep working like it was nothing. washing the lettuce or the broccoli, whatever it was, all the while interpreting. Linda and Victor set up a paid internship program to train informal Indigenous interpreters. Angelica was their first intern. But hiring interns was just the beginning. Victor says many of these languages didn't have words for diseases, medical procedures, equipment.
One of our doctors, conversing with a Zapotec patient, was trying to figure out how they would describe tuberculosis. And the Zapotec individual said that it was something similar to, like, the devil is strangling my neck. Mm. You know, is it okay for the interpreter to describe it as you have the devil is strangling your neck disease?
Linda also realized that she had to train the doctors too.
They too have to be trained to understand what the context is not. When they say, I'm going to the lab, well, what's the lab? They have no idea what a lab is.
As a kid, Israel was bullied a lot for being Oaxacan and speaking Triqui. Now, old classmates ask him all the time how they might work at the hospital too. Well, he says, you need to speak Spanish and English and an Indigenous language.
I'm really proud that my language is important here.
Nina Perzuki reported this story. It originally appeared on a podcast about language called The World in Words.
They're the pulse. Hakayat anin nas, makan, wimarakiz, il olum, wisaha.
That's how we might introduce the pulse in Arabic. When you watch a child who's just beginning to speak, it's amazing how effortlessly words come to them and how they can just connect concepts and words to make phrases. For adults learning language for the first time, this is a very different process. Reporter Alex Smith met a group of refugees trying to learn how to communicate.
At a small house in Kansas City, Kansas, a local church holds a weekly American Sign Language class for deaf adults. The dozen students are almost all refugees from Bhutan, a tiny Himalayan country.
So in Bhutan, I was really, really young. I think I was 7 years old, and then they sent us to Nepal.
Starting in the late 80s, Bhutan began driving out people who were ethnically Nepali. They fled across the mountains to Nepal, where they were settled in refugee camps. Maita is deaf. He told me his story using sign language. The voice you're hearing is another Bhutanese refugee speaking Maita's words for him. To protect their family's privacy, the class members asked me to use only their first names. Many people in Bhutan and Nepal lose their hearing because they don't have access to basic health care. Without treatment, common ear infections, high fevers, and measles can cause deafness. There's also a stigma, and Maita says it's common for families to keep deaf people hidden away.
Some who could talk had a better life. It was different if you are deaf, not a good life.
Like many deaf people in the region, he didn't go to school growing up, so he didn't learn sign language, reading, or writing. Deaf people were often stuck using informal hand gestures with friends and family. American Sign Language is Maita's first real language. He and the rest of the class sit in a circle of couches and watch their teacher, Pastor Debbie Buchholz, use her hands to introduce Dao. A new student.
Her name? D-A-O. Dao.
Dao is a woman in her 40s, and she looks terrified.
She has never been to school, the same as you. No school. She doesn't know sign language, nothing. You are her friends.
Debbie, who leads Kansas City's Deaf International Community Church, has her students teach me their names, Maita, Guman, Don, Harka.
My name is H-A-R-K-A.
Harka, so two fingers on the right of the forehead.
On the right
Okay.
Or at least they try to teach me. Yeah. It's tricky to make the hand signs, and I get the positions mixed up. Learning a new language as an adult is a struggle. But what these students are doing, learning their first language as adults, is really hard. And scientists are just starting to understand why.
Are you ready for your walk?
Yeah.
Can you say hello?
Hello.
That's my son, Ari. He's 15 months old. He's saying some of his first words, mama, dada, hello, bye-bye. His mom and I tried deliberately to teach him certain words or phrases. We ask again and again questions like, is that a tree? Can you say tree? He probably thinks this is ridiculous, and he might be right. Linguist Rachel Mayberry says our lessons probably aren't needed. Rachel teaches at the University of California, San Diego, and says all it takes for a young child to learn a language is to be surrounded by people using it.
Children themselves, in an unconscious process that we don't quite understand, are able to, through this barrage of talk that they hear, to figure out the grammar of language.
But this magic window of language learning only stays open for so long. Rachel scans the brains of language learners and says certain areas seem evolved to process grammar, but if they aren't used by age 9 or 10, they start to shut down.
Although they're specialized for language, we see that for them to become fully operational or fully functional or fully wired, so to speak, that actually requires this early stimulation.
Late language learners usually don't, or possibly can't, use complex sentence structure or abstract vocabulary. But Rachel says they do have some advantages. When a child, like my son Ari, is first learning a word, say, hot, he's learning both the word and the concept at the same time. Adult learners already know the concepts, so they can pick up vocabulary really quickly.
There is this recognition of, oh my gosh, everything has a name. Oh my gosh, I can put these concepts together.
In the sign language class, the more advanced students practice their new language skills by telling stories. Most are in their 30s, 40s, or 50s, and this is the first time they've been able to tell others about what they lived through. Again, the students used sign language, and other refugees voiced their stories.
Men would stand in the forest and hide. They wanted to rape the women, and we would say, no, no, and run away.
There was cold and snow. You couldn't walk on the snow because you could fall and be killed.
I grew up in the refugee camp. I didn't even know there was another place other than this camp.
Come on, let's go in.
Many of the refugees spend all day inside their apartment, so a recent class outing to the grocery store is a big deal. As they walk past aisles of bright food and packaging, the students seem to light up as they come across familiar things like yucca root that they knew from Bhutan and Nepal.
Where? Honeydew melon, where? I'm looking, she said, I'm looking.
But teacher Debbie Buchold says the excitement doesn't always translate to new language skills. Because they're late to language learning, sometimes the lessons just don't stick. Some of the class members go for months without any progress. Others never seem to get it. Buchold understands her students may never be fluent, but that's not the point of the classes.
Well, no matter what statistics say, I know that they're out there and I understand all that, but I believe in not giving up and I believe in giving them something that they can use to have a voice in this world.
Alex Smith reported this story from Kansas City. You're listening to The Pulse. We've been talking about language. Think about your voice for a minute. It's unique, like your fingerprint. Would you be willing to share it with another person? There's a service called Vocal ID where you can become a speech donor. You add your voice to a bank, and eventually it's turned into a personalized synthetic voice for somebody else who has lost their own due to illness or disability. The process can be tedious. You have to read and record lots of phrases.
So strange was the dream.
Tickle the frog with the feather.
Internet of things.
It's always cold in San Francisco.
Please be patient.
The ripe taste of cheese.
By Bobby, a pups with age. Nod if you
this is Erin Anderson. She produced this story while she was in the process of donating her voice.
Don't always get along. Food.
I always spoil
cut
everything.
Off from all the rest
welcome.
Of the world.
It doesn't matter, I guess.
Hello. This is my voice vault. It is still incomplete. I am donating my voice to someone I've never met. Someone I may never meet at all. Every word I'm speaking will someday be hers. As I lean into the microphone and read out the words,
hi,
I feel strangely like I'm speaking to her.
How are you?
We make idle chit-chat.
Good to see you.
Exchange pleasantries.
How is your cat?
Platitudes. And cliches.
Good friends are forever.
I pass judgment.
Winking isn't ladylike.
And blame.
You are so careless.
I make confessions.
Ice cream complaints, is my guilty pleasure.
And commands.
Take the children to the zoo.
Occasionally, I say please.
Please put the groceries in the refrigerator.
I speak to her like I speak to Siri.
It's late.
When I want to text my ETA to a friend from the freeway.
Order a sausage pizza for dinner.
Slowly. Dispassionately.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Tisking my T's with a faux sophistication that I once brought home from a semester abroad in Britain.
Tell me about your family.
Part of me expects her to respond. But of course she doesn't.
Tell me about it.
She can't. That's precisely the point. And in the end...
What have you done?
She isn't Siri.
Who, me?
I am.
I am made of tin.
Is that so?
I have no heart and cannot love.
I've never really thought about it.
This sounds like the real me.
Sorry, Aaron. I didn't get that.
This sounds like the real me.
I'm not sure I understand.
This sounds like the real me.
I thought so.
This is my new voice.
If you asked me how I feel about my voice, I'd probably tell you this. It's a little like my hair. A little thin, a little flat, a little mousy.
Only a mouse. I saw a mouse once.
As a kid, I dreamed of being Little Orphan Annie, belting it out on Broadway with a mop of tight, fiery curls.
We like singing. They all drew to the fire.
In second grade, I sang Maybe, off-key and a cappella in a dirty blonde bowl cut at the spring talent show. I practiced at recess for weeks. I wanted to be famous.
I am real. I know I am real.
Or maybe just to be heard. But for some of us, there's only this.
I communicate with a computer system in a box in the back of my wheelchair.
I use this machine for communication. I can hear and understand everything that you say.
Some of us will never sing, even badly.
I get by with a little help from my friends.
Get help now. Can you help me find my way? I don't know where it is. What are you hiding behind you?
As the words pile up, I try to remember this.
Have some coffee. It's very hot in here.
I try to hear myself as she might, from the outside, listening in.
One by one, on and on they walked.
And with each word,
does it hurt?
The sounds feel less and less like my own.
Aren't they beautiful? We do want to be good.
And then suddenly, it stops.
After 3,487 sentences, my voice vault now contains all of the building blocks of human speech, the seeds of an entirely new voice, which brings together the sounds of her body and of mine. I hope she will come to love it or to hate it like her own.
Erin Anderson produced this story. A longer version of it aired on KCRW's Unfictional. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our interns are Elizabeth Estrada and Abby Holtzman. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, Alan Yu, and Liz Tung. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Alex Stern is our associate producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care. Penn Medicine supports the Pulse. Some of us live for the future, but what if tomorrow is too late? That's why today at Penn Medicine, their breakthroughs are helping to change lives. Healthy cells can now find and eliminate cancer cells. Focused ultrasound is taking the place of brain surgery to correct essential tremor. And vision is being restored using a genetic treatment. That's why your life is worth Penn Medicine. Learn more at PennMedicine.org.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at PartnersWithAPurpose.org.